Quite out of nowhere, just over the crest of a tiny slope, the grassy field broke out into a graveyard. It contained perhaps 40 gravestones and was surrounded by a knee-high stone wall, covered in slippery moss. This would be the last and final resting place of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Lindsay Lee Wells said, her voice suddenly affected with a new cadence of that bored tour guide who long ago memorized her speech. Colin and Hassan followed her to a 6-foot-tall obelisk, a kind of miniature Washington monument, before which lay a plethora of not-new pink silk roses. Though obviously fake, the flowers still seemed wilted. Lindsay sat down on the mossy wall. "Ah, screw the speech. You probably know this anyway," she said, nodding towards Colin. "But I'll tell the story. The Archduke was born in December 1863 in Austria. His uncle was the Emperor Francis Joseph, but being the Austro-Hungarian Empire's new nephew didn't matter much, unless, say, the Emperor's only son, Rudolf, happens to shoot himself in the head, which is what, in fact, happened in 1889. All of a sudden, Franz Ferdinand was next in line for the throne. They called Franz the loneliest man in Vienna, Colin said to Hassan. Yeah, well, no one liked him because he was a total nerd, Lindsay said, except he was one of those nerds who isn't even very smart. Yeah, average, inbred, 96-pound weakling type. His family thought he was a liberal wuss. Viennese society thought he was an idiot, like actual tongue-hanging-out-of-your-mouth idiot. And then he went and made matters worse by marrying for love. He married this girl named Sophie in 1900, and everyone thought she was just totally low rent. But, you know, in the guy's defence, he really loved her. That's what I never tell the tour, but from everything I've read about Franzi, he and Sophie had about the happiest marriage in the whole history of the royalty. Sort of a cute story, except for how on their 14th wedding anniversary, June 28th, 1914, they were both shot dead in Sarajevo. The Emperor had them both buried outside of Vienna. He didn't even bother to attend the funeral, but he cared enough about his nephew to go ahead and start World War I, which he did by declaring war on Serbia about a month later. She stood up. "Thus ends the tour," she smiled. "Tips are appreciated." Colin and Hassan clapped politely, then Colin walked over to the obelisk, which read only, "Archduke Franz Ferdinand, 1863-1914, lie lightly upon him earth, though he laid many a heavy burden upon thee." Heavy burdens indeed, millions of them. Colin reached out and felt the granite, cool despite the hot sun. And what had the Archduke Franz Ferdinand done that he might have done differently? If he hadn't obsessed over love, hadn't been so tactless, so whiny, so nerdy. Maybe if he hadn't been, Colin thought, so much like me. In the end, the Archduke had two problems. No one gave a shit about him, at least not until his corpse started a war, and one day he got a piece taken out of his middle. But now Colin would fill his own hole, and make people stand up and take notice of him. He would stay special. Use his talent to do something more interesting and important than anagramming and translating Latin. And yes, again the eureka washed over him, the yes, yes, yes of it. He would use his past, and the Archduke's past, and the whole endless past to inform the future. He would impress Catherine 19. She'd always loved the idea of him being a genius, and he would make the world safer to dumpies everywhere. He would matter. From which reverie he was woken by Hassan asking, "So how the fuck did a perfectly good Austrian archduke end up in Schittsburg, Tennessee?" "We bought him," Lindsay Lee Wells said. "Around 1921. The owner of the castle where he was buried needed money and put him up for sale, and we bought him." "How much did a dead archduke cost in those days?" Hassan wondered. "About $3,500, they say." "That's a lot of money," Colin said, his hand still on the granite obelisk. "The dollar rose by a factor of more than 10 between 1920 and now, so that's more than $35,000 in today's dollars, and a lot of tours at 11 bucks apiece." Lindsay Lee Wells rolled her eyes. "Okay, okay, I am sufficiently impressed, enough already. You know, we got these things down here. I don't know if you have them where you're from. But they're called calculators, and they can do all that work for you." I wasn't trying to impress anyone, Colin insisted defensively. And then Lindsay's eyes lit up and she cupped her hands over her mouth and shouted, Hey! Three guys and one girl were trudging up the slope, their heads visible. Kids from school, Lindsay explained, and my boyfriend. Lindsay Lee Wells took off running toward them. Colin and Hassan stood still and began chatting quickly back and forth. Hassan said, I'm a Kuwaiti exchange student. My dad's an oil baron. Colin shook his head. Too obvious. I'm a Spaniard, a refugee. My parents were murdered by Basque separatists. I don't know if Basque is a thing or a person, and neither will they, so no. Okay, I just got to America from Honduras. My name is Miguel. My parents made a fortune in bananas, and you're my bodyguard because the Banana Workers Union wants me dead. Colin shot back. That's good, but you don't speak Spanish. Okay, I was abducted by Eskimos in the Yukon No, that's crap. We're cousins from France, visiting the United States for the first time. It's our high school graduation trip. That's boring, but we're out of time. I'm the English speaker? Hassan asked. Yeah, fine. By now, Colin could hear the group chatting and see Lindsay Lee Wells' eyes staring up at a tall, muscular boy wearing a Tennessee Titans jersey. The boy was a hulking mass of muscle with spiked hair and a smile that was all top teeth and gums. The success of the game depended on Lindsay having not talked about Colin and Hassan, but Colin figured it was a safe bet, as she seemed pretty enthralled with the boy. Okay, they're coming, said Hassan. What's your name? Pierre. Okay, I'm Salinze. Pronounced Salinze. Y'all here for the tour, are you? Lindsay's boyfriend said. Yes, I am Salinze, Hassan said, his accent passable if not magnificent. This is my cousin Pierre. We visit your country for the first time, and we wish to see the Archduke, who started our, how you say, First Earth War. Colin glanced at Lindsay Lee Wells, who suppressed a smile as she smacked orange gum. I'm Colin, said the boyfriend said, his hand extended. Hassan leaned over to Pierre/Colin and whispered, His name is the other Colin. Hassan then said, My cousin. He speak very little English. I am his man of translate. The other Colin laughed, as did the other two boys, who quickly introduced themselves as Chase and Fulton. We'll call Chase, jeans are too tight, and Fulton shall be short one chewing tobacco, Hassan whispered to Colin. Je m'appelle Pierre, Colin blurted out after the boys have introduced himself. Quand je vais de le métro, je fais aussi de la musique de proue. We get a lot of foreign tourists here, said the only girl beside Lindsay, who was tall and thoroughly Abercrombie-fied in her tight tank top. The girl also had, how to put this politely, gigantic gazumbas. She was incredibly hot in that popular girl with bleached teeth and anorexia kind of way, which was Colin's least favourite way of being hot. I'm Katrina, by the way. Close, Colin thought, but no cigar. Amour, aime, amour, Colin announced loudly. Pierre, said Hassan. He has the disease with the talking, with the bad words. In France we say it, the Tourette's. I don't know how you say it in English. He has Tourette's, asked Katrina. Merde, shouted Colin. Yes, Hassan said excitedly. Same word, both language. Like hemorrhoid. The one we learned yesterday because Pierre had the fire in his bottom. He also has the Tourette's and the hemorrhoid, but is good boy. Ne dis pas que j'ai des hémorroïdes. Je n'ai pas de hémorroïdes, Colin shouted, at once trying to continue the game and get Hassan onto a different topic. Hassan looked at Colin, nodded knowingly, and then told Katrina, He just said that your face, it is beautiful like the hemorrhoid. At which point Lindsay Lee Wells burst out laughing and said, okay, enough. Colin turned to Hassan and said, Why do it have to be hemorrhoids? How the hell did that idea pop into your mind? And then the other Colin, and jeans are too tight, and the short one chewing tobacco, and Katrina were all abuzz, talking and laughing and asking Lindsay questions. My dad went to France last year, dude, explained Hassan, and he told the story about getting a hemorrhoid and having to point at his butt and say the French word for fire over and over again until it came out that the word was hemorrhoid in both languages. And I didn't know any of the fucking French words, Plus, that's some funny shit, you having Tourette's and hemorrhoids. Whatever, Colin said, his face flushed. And then he overheard the other Colin saying, that's awful funny. Hollis would love them, huh? And Lindsay laughed and reached up on her tiptoes to kiss him and then said, I got you good, baby. He said, well, they got me. And Lindsay faked like she was pouting and the other Colin leaned down to kiss her forehead and she brightened. The same scene had played out in Colin's own life frequently, although he'd usually been the fake pouter. They trudged back through the field as a group, Colin's sweat-soaked T-shirt sticky and tight against his back, his eyes still throbbing. The theorem of underlying Catherine predictability, he thought. Even the name rang true. He had waited so long for his breakthrough, despaired so many times, and he just wanted to be alone for a little while, with a pencil and some paper and a calculator and no talking. In the car would work. Colin tugged softly on Hassan's shirt and gave him a meaningful look. I just need some Gatorade, Hassan responded. Then we'll go. I'll need to open up the store for you then, Lindsay said. She turned to the other Colin. Come with me, baby. The gooey softness of her voice reminded Colin of Catherine 19. I would, the other Colin said, except Hollis is sitting out on the steps. Me and Chase is supposed to be at work, but we skipped out. The other Colin picked her off her feet and squeezed her tight, his biceps flexing. She squirmed a little but kissed him hard, her mouth open. Then he dropped her down, winked, and trudged off with his entourage towards a red pickup truck. When Lindsay, Hassan, and Colin arrived back at the Gutshot General Store, a large woman wearing a pink floral dress was sitting on the steps talking to a man with a bushy brown beard. As they approached, Colin could hear the woman telling a story. So Stans is out there to mow the lawn, she was saying, and he turns off the mower and looks up and appraises the situation for a bit, and then calls out to me, Hollis, what the hell is wrong with that dog? And I says to him, the dog's got inflamed anal sacs that I just drained. And Stans chews that one over for a while, and then he says, I reckon you could go ahead and shoot that dog and get you another one with regular anal sacs and nobody won't be any the wiser. And then I tell him, Stans, this town ain't got any men worth loving, so I might as well love my dog. The bearded guy bent over in laughter, and then the storyteller looked over at Lindsay. You run a tour? Hollis asked. When Lindsay nodded, Hollis went on. Well, you sure God took your time. Sorry, mumbled Lindsay, nodding to the guys. She said, Hollis, this is Hassan and Colin. Boys, this is Hollis. Also known as Lindsay's mother, Hollis explained. Christ, Hollis, don't go bragging about it, Lindsay said. She walked past her mum, unlocked the store, and everyone walked into the sweet air conditioning. As Colin passed, Hollis put a hand on his shoulder, spun him round and stared at his face. I know you, she said. I don't know you, Colin responded, and then added by way of an explanation. I don't forget many faces. Hollis Wells continued to stare at him, but he was sure they had never met. He means that literally, Hassan added, peering up from behind a rack of comic books. Do you guys get newspapers here? From behind the counter, Lindsay Lee Wells produced USA Today. Hassan paged through the front section and finally folded the paper back to reveal only a small black and white picture of a thick-haired, bespectacled white male. Do you know this guy? Hassan asked. Colin squinted at the paper and thought for a moment. I don't personally know of him, but his name is Gil Stable, and he's the CEO of a company called Fortiscom. Good work! Except he's not the CEO of Fortiscom. Yes, he is, Colin said quite confident. No, he's not. He's not the CEO of anything. He's dead. Hassan unfolded the paper and Colin leaned in to read the caption. Fortiscom CEO dies in plane crash. Cranial kids! Hollis shouted triumphantly. Colin looked up at her, wide-eyed. He sighed. No one watched that show. Its Nielsen share was 0.0. The show had been on for one season, and not a single soul among Chicago's 3 million residents had ever recognized him. And yet here, in Gutshot, Tennessee... Oh my God, Hollis shouted. What are you doing here? Colin flushed for a moment with a feeling of famousness, thought about it. I cracked up, and then we went on a road trip, and then we saw the sign for the Archduke, Then I cut my head. Then I had a eureka moment. Then we met her friends. Now we're going back to the car, but we haven't left yet. Hollis stepped forward and examined his bandage. She smiled and with one hand reached up for his jufro and mussed his hair like she was his aunt and he was a 7-year-old who'd just done something exceedingly cute. "You're not leaving yet either," she said, "because I'm going to cook you dinner." Hassan clapped his hands together. "I am hungry." "Close her down, Linz." Lindsay rolled her eyes and walked slowly out from behind the register. "You drive with Colin in case he gets lost," Hollis told Lindsay. "I'll take... what did you say your name was?" "I'm not a terrorist," Hassan said by way of answering. "Well, that's a relief," Hollis smiled. Hollis drove a new and impressively pink pickup truck, and Colin followed in the hearse, with Lindsay riding shotgun. "Nice car," she said sarcastically. Colin didn't respond. He liked Lindsay Lee Wells, but sometimes it felt like she was trying to get his goat. He had had the same problem with Hassan. "Thanks for not saying anything when I was Pierre and Hassan was Salinger." "Yeah, well, it was pretty funny. And plus, Colin was being sort of a dick and needed to be taken down a peg." "See," said Colin, which is what he'd learned to say when he had nothing to say. "So," she said, "you're a genius."
"I'm a washed-up child prodigy," Colin said.
"What are you good at, other than just already knowing everything?"
Languages, word games, trivia, nothing useful."
He felt her glance at him.
"Languages are useful. What do you speak?"
"I'm pretty good in 11. German, French, Latin, Greek, Dutch, Arabic, Spanish, Russian."
"I get the picture," she said.
"I think that meine Mutter denkt, dab sie gut für mich sind," she said. "That's why we're in this car together."
I'm not even pronouncing that.
"Okay, we've both proven we speak German. She's been on my ass like crazy to go to college and become, I don't know, a doctor or something. Only I'm not going. I'm staying here. I already make it up my mind about that. So I'm thinking maybe she wants you to inspire me or something."
"Doctors make more money than paramedics in training," Colin pointed out.
"Right, but I don't need money." She paused and the car rumbled beneath them. Finally, he glanced over at her.
"I need my life," she explained. "Which is good and which is here. And anyway, I might go up to the community college in Bradford to shut Hollis up, but that's it."
The road took a sharp banked turn to the right and past a small stand of trees, a town emerged. Small but well-kept houses lined the road. They all had porches, it seemed, and a lot of people were sitting out on them, even though it was hotter than hell in summertime. On the main road, Colin noted a newish combination gas station and a Taco Bell, a hair salon and the Gutshot, Tennessee post office, which appeared from the road to be the size of a spacious walk-in closet. Lindsay pointed out Colin's window. "Out there's the factory," she said, and in the middle distance, Colin saw a complex of low-lying buildings. It didn't look much like a factory, no towering steel silos or smokestacks billowing carbon monoxide, just a few buildings that vaguely reminded him of airplane hangars.
"What does it make?" Colin asked.
"It makes jobs. It makes all the jobs in this town. My great-grandfather started the plant in 1917. Colin slowed down, pulling to the shoulder so that a speeding SUV could pass him whilst he looked out at the factory with Lindsay.
"Right, but what gets made there?" he asked.
"You'll laugh."
"I won't laugh."
"Swear not to laugh," she said.
"I swear."
"It's a textile mill. These days we make, tampon strings." Colin didn't laugh. Instead, he thought,
"Tampons have strings? Why?"
Of all the major human mysteries, God, the nature of the universe, etc., he knew the least about tampons. To Colin, tampons were a little bit like grizzly bears. He was aware of their existence, but he'd never seen one in the wild, and he didn't really care to. In lieu of Colin's laugh came a period of unbreachable silence. He followed Hollis's pink truck down a newly paved side street that sloped up precipitously, causing the hearse's worn-out engine to rev for its very life. As they climbed the hill, it became clear that the street was actually a long driveway,
which dead-ended into the largest single-family residence that Colin had ever personally laid eyes upon. It was also glaringly, bubblegumlingly, pepto-bismally pink. He pulled into the driveway. Colin was staring at it, somewhat slack-jawed, when Lindsay poked him softly on the arm. Lindsay shrugged, as if embarrassed. "It ain't much," she said, "but it's home." A broad staircase led up to a heavily columned front porch. Hollis opened the door, and Colin and Hassan walked into a cavernous living room, outfitted with a couch long enough for both of them to lie down on without touching. "You'll make yourselves at home. Lindsay and I are going to get dinner ready." "You can probably handle that on your own," Lindsay said, leaning against the front door. "I probably could, but I ain't gonna." Hassan sat down on the couch. "That Hollis is a riot, man. On the way over here, she was telling me that she owns a factory that makes tampon strings." Colin still did not find this particularly hilarious. "You know," Colin said, "the movie star Jane Mansfield lived in a pink mansion." He walked around the living room, reading the spines of Hollis's books and looking at framed photographs. A picture on the mantel above their fireplace caught Colin's eye, and he walked over to it. A slightly younger, slightly thinner Hollis was standing in front of Niagara Falls. Beside her stood a girl who looked a little like Lindsay Lee Wells, except the girl wore a black trench coat over a ratty old Blink-182 t-shirt. Her eyeliner was thick and stretched back towards her temples, her tight black jeans, tight and tapered, her Doc Martens well polished. "Does she have a sister?" Colin asked. "What? Lindsay," Colin elaborated. "Come here and look at this." Hassan came over and briefly appraised the picture before saying, "This is the most pathetic attempt I've ever seen to be a goth. Goth kids don't like Blink-182. God, even I know that." "Do you like green beans?" Lindsay asked, and Colin suddenly realised she was behind them. "Is this your sister?" asked Colin. No, she said to Colin. "I'm an only child. Can't you tell by how adorably self-involved I am?" He was too busy being adorably self-involved to notice, Hassan interjected. "So who is this?" Colin asked Lindsay. "It's me in 8th grade. "Oh," said Colin and Hassan simultaneously, both embarrassed. "Yeah, I like green beans," Hassan said, trying to change the subject as quickly as possible. Lindsay pulled shut the kitchen door behind her, and Hassan shrugged towards Colin and smirked and then returned to the couch. "I need to work," Colin said. He found his way down a pink wallpapered hallway and into a room with a huge wooden desk that looked like the kind of place where a president might sign a bill into law. Colin sat down, pulled from his pocket the broken No. 2 pencil and omnipresent notebook and began to scribble. "The theorem rests upon the validity of my long-standing argument that the world contains precisely two kinds of people, dumpers and dumpees. Everyone is predisposed to being either one or the other, but of course not all our people are complete dumpers or dumpees, hence the bell curve. The majority of people fall somewhere close to the vertical dividing line, with the occasional statistical outlier, e.g. me, representing a tiny percentage of overall individuals. Numerical expression of the graph can be something like 5 being extreme dumper and 0 being me. Ergo, if the great one was a 4 and I am a 0, the total size of dumper-dumpy differential equals -4, assuming negative numbers if the guy is more of a dumpy, positive if the girl is. And then he sought a graphable equation that would express his relationship with the great one, the simplest of all his romances, as it actually was, nasty, brutish, and short. For some reason, he discarded the equations left and right. The room seemed to grow warmer. Sweat pooled in the gauze bandage over his eyes, so he tore it off. He removed his shirt, wiping still trickling blood from his face. Naked from the waist up, his vertebrae extruded from his skinny back as he hunched over the desk, working. He felt as he had never felt before, that he was close to an original concept. Plenty of people, Colin included, had noted the dumper-dumpy dichotomy before, but no one had ever used to show the arc of romantic relationships. He doubted that anyone had ever imagined that a single formula could predict the rise and fall of romances universally. He knew it wouldn't be easy, For one thing, turning concept into numbers was a sort of anagramming to which he was unaccustomed. But he had confidence. He'd never been all that good at math, but he was a goddamn world-famous expert in getting dumped. He kept at the formula, haunted by the feeling that his head was just about to wrap around something big and important, and when he proved he mattered, she would miss him. He knew. She would see him as she had in the beginning, with genius. Within an hour, he had an equation. The function of x equals d cubed x squared minus d, which made Catherine the First look like this. It was a near perfect, that was a nearly perfect, an uncomplicated graphical representation of an uncomplicated relationship. It even captured the relationship's brevity. The graphs didn't need to represent time accurately. They merely needed to give an idea of length by comparison, i.e. she'll date me longer than K-14, but not as long as K-19. But Catherine the Second came out all wrong, only touching the x-axis once. Clearly it wasn't refined enough yet to send out notice to the annals of mathematics, or anything, but Colin felt good enough to slink back into his shirt. Happier than he'd been in, well, at least the last 2 days, Colin hurried down the hallway and burst into the coolness of the living room, where he saw through a doorway that Lindsay and Hassan and Hollis were seated in the dining room. He walked in and sat down before a plate of rice, green beans, and what appeared to be very small chickens. Hassan was already laughing about something, and so were both the Wellses. Already they seemed to love him. People just liked Hassan, the way that people like fast food and celebrities. It was a gift Colin found amazing. The moment Colin sat down, Hollis asked Hassan, "Would you like to say grace?" "Sure thing," Hassan cleared his throat. "Bismillah." And then he picked up his fork. "That's it?" Hollis wondered. "That's it. We are a terse people, terse and also hungry." The Arabic seemed to render everyone uncomfortable or something, because no one talked for a few minutes except Hassan, who kept saying that the quail, it was quail, not tiny chicken, was excellent. And it was good, Colin supposed, if you happen to enjoy searching through an endless labyrinth of bones and cartilage for the occasional sliver of meat. He hunted around with his fork and knife for the edible parts, and finally located one entire bite of meat. He chewed it so slowly as to relish it, chewing and chewing and ouch. What the hell was that? Chew, 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 and again, fug. "Is that a bone? Ow," he said softly. "Birdshot," Lindsay told him.
"Birdshot?"
"Birdshot," Hollis agreed. "The bird was shot?" Colin asked, spitting out a tiny metal pellet.
"Yup. And I'm eating the bullets?"
Lindsay smiled. "Nope, you're spitting them out." And so it was that Colin dined that evening primarily on rice and green beans. After everyone had finished, Hollis asked, "So how did it feel to win Cranial Kids? I remember on the show you didn't seem that, excited."
"I felt really bad against the other kid losing. She was really nice, the kid I played against. She took it kind of hard."
"I was happy enough for the both of us," said Hassan. "I was the only member of the studio audience dancing a jig. Singleton beat that little fugger like she'd stolen something."
Cranial Kids reminded Colin of Catherine 19, and he stared straight ahead and tried hard to think of as little as possible. When Hollis spoke, it seemed to break a long quiet the alarm clocks do.
"I think you all should work for me this summer in Gutshot. I'm starting a project and you'd be perfect for it." Over the years, people had occasionally sought to employ Colin in a manner better benefiting his talents. But A, summers were for Smart Kid Camp so that he could further his learning, and B, a real job would distract him from his real work, which was becoming an ever larger repository of knowledge. And see, Colin didn't really have any marketable skills. One rarely comes across, for instance, the following want ad. Prodigy. "Huge, megalithic corporation seeks a talented, ambitious prodigy to join our exciting, dynamic prodigy division for a summer job. Requirements include at least 14 years' experience as a certified child prodigy, ability to anagram adeptly and alliterate agilely, fluency in 11 languages. Job duties include reading, remembering encyclopedias,
novels and poetry, and memorising the first 99 digits of pi. And so every summer, Colin went to Smart Kid Camp, and with each passing year, it became increasingly clear to him that he wasn't qualified to do anything, which is what he told Hollis Wells. "I just need you to be reasonably smart and not from gutshot, and you both fit the bill. $500 a week for both y'all, plus free room and board. You're hired. Welcome to the Gutshot Textiles family." Colin shot a glance at his friend, who held a quail daintily in his hand, his teeth gnawing at the bone in a vain search for a half-decent meal. Hassan placed the quail carefully back on the plate and looked back at Colin. Hassan nodded subtly. Colin's lips pursed. Hassan rubbed at his 5 o'clock shadow. Colin bit at the inside of his thumb. Hassan smiled. Colin nodded. "Okay," Colin said finally. They had decided to stay. Like it or not, Colin thought, road trips have destinations. Or at least his kind of road trip always would. This seemed a fair endpoint, sweet, if ceaselessly pink. Accommodations, reasonably nice people, one of whom made him feel slightly famous. And the home of his first ever Eureka. Colin didn't need the money, but he knew how much Hassan hated begging spending money off his parents. And also, they could both use a job. Neither of them, it occurred to Colin, had ever, technically, worked for money before. So Colin's only worry was the theorem. Insert some Arabic. "Can we just make sure Singleton has enough time to doodle?" Hassan asked in English. "Is that some kind of gibberish?" Lindsay interrupted, incredulous. Colin ignored her, responding in English to Hassan. "It's not doodling, which you'd know if you went to college, right? God, so predictable," Hassan said, and then he turned to Lindsay and said, "We are not speaking gibberish. We are speaking the sacred language of the Quran, the language of great Khalifa and Saladin, the most beautiful and intricate of all human tongues." "Well, it sounds like a raccoon clearing its throat," Lindsay noted. Colin stopped for a moment to ponder that. "I just need time to do my work," Colin said, and Hollis just nodded. "Splendid." Lindsay seemed genuine. "Splendid, but you can't have my room." His mouth half full of rice, Hassan said, "I think we'll be able to find a place to hunker down somewhere in this house." After a while, Hollis announced, "We should play Scrabble." Lindsay groaned. "I've never played," Colin said. "A genius who's never played Scrabble?" Lindsay asked. "I'm not a genius." "Okay, a smarty pants." Colin laughed. It suited him. No longer a prodigy, not yet a genius, but still a smarty pants. "I don't play games," Colin said. "I don't really play much." "Well, you should. Playing is fun. Although Scrabble isn't really the A1 way of doing it," Lindsay said. Final scores: Hollis 158, Colin 521, Lindsay 293, Hassan 0. After he called his parents and told him he was in a town called Gutshot, but failed to mention he was boarding with strangers, Colin stayed up late working on the theorem on his new bedroom on the second floor, which featured a nice oak desk with empty drawers. Colin, for whatever reason, had always loved desks with empty drawers. But the theorem didn't go well. He was beginning to worry that he might lack the math expertise for the job when he glanced up to see the bedroom door opening. Lindsay Lee Wells was wearing paisley pyjamas. "How's the head?" she asked, sitting down on his bed. He closed his right eye and then opened it, and then pressed a finger against his cut. "It hurts," he responded. "Thanks for your treatment, though." She folded her legs beneath her, smiled and sang, "That's what friends are for." But then she turned serious, almost shy. "Listen, I wonder if I could just tell you something." She bit at the inside of her thumb. "Hey, I do that," Colin said, pointing. "Oh, weird. It's like the poor man's thumb-sucking, isn't it? Anyway, I only do it in private," Lindsay said. And it occurred to Colin that being around him was not really private, but he didn't pursue it. "Right. So anyway, this will sound retarded, but I think I can just tell you about the picture, so that you don't think I'm an absolute asshole. Because I've been lying in bed, thinking about what an asshole you probably think I am, and how you and Hassan are probably talking about what an asshole I am and everything." Okay, he said, although frankly, he and Hassan had plenty of other things to talk about. "So, I was ugly, I was never fat, really, and I never wore headgear or had zits or anything, but I was ugly. I don't even know how ugly and pretty get decided. Maybe there's a secret cabal of boys who meet in the locker room and decide who's ugly and who's hot. Because as far as I can remember, there was no such thing as a hot fourth grader. Clearly you men never met Catherine the First, interrupted Colin. Rule number one of stories, no interrupting, but haha, perv. Anyway, I was ugly. I got picked on a lot. I'm not going to bore you with the stories about how bad it was, but it was pretty bad, and I was miserable. And so in eighth grade I went all alternative. Hollis and I drove to Memphis, and we bought me a whole new wardrobe, and I got me a Zelda haircut and dyed it black, and stopped going outside in the sun, and I was like half emo, and half goth, and half punk, and half nerd chic. Basically, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but it didn't matter, because the middle school in Milan, Tennessee, had never seen an emo, or a goth, or punk, or nerd chic. I was different, and that was all. And I hated all of them, and they hated me for an entire year. And then high school started, and I decided to make them like me. I just decided. It was so easy. I was so, so easy, and I just became it. And if it walks like a cool kid, and talks like a cool kid, and dresses like a cool kid, and has the right mix of naughty and nasty and nice like a cool kid, it becomes a cool kid. But I'm not an asshole to people. There's not even really popularity at my school. That, Colin said emphatically, is a sentence that has only been spoken by popular people. Okay, but I'm not just some former ugly girl who sold her soul to date hotties and go to the finest keg parties the greater Gutshot area has to offer. She repeated it almost defensively. I didn't sell my soul. Okay, I wouldn't care if you did, Colin acknowledged. Nerds always say they don't give a shit about popularity, but not having friends sucks. I never liked quote-unquote cool kids personally, but I thought they were all dumb little shits, but I'm probably like them in some ways. Like the other day, I told Hassan I wanted to matter, like be remembered, and he said, famous is the new popular. Maybe he's right, maybe I just want to be famous. I was thinking about this tonight, actually, that maybe I want strangers to think I'm cool, since people who actually don't know me don't. I was at a zoo once, on a class trip, and I really needed to pee, right? I actually had repeated urges to urinate that day, probably due to overhydration. Incidentally, did you know that the whole 8 glasses a day is a complete bullshit and has absolutely no scientific basis? So many things are like that. Everyone just assumes they're true, because people are basically lazy and incurious, which incidentally is one of those words that sound like it isn't a word, but it is. It's very weird to watch your brain work, Lindsay said, and Colin sighed. He knew he couldn't tell stories. That's why he always included extraneous details and tangents that only interested him. Anyway, the end of the story is that I came relatively close to having a lion bite off my penis. And my point was that shit like that never happens to popular people. Ever. Lindsay laughed. That sounds like hell of a good story, if only you knew how to tell it. She bit at her thumb again, her private habit. From behind her hand, she said, well, I think you're cool, and I want you to think I'm cool, and that's all popular is. The end of the beginning. After their first kiss, Colin and Catherine One sat in silence for perhaps 2 minutes. Catherine watched Colin carefully as he tried to continue translating Ovid, but he found himself with an unprecedented problem. Colin couldn't focus. He kept glancing up at her, her big blue eyes too big for her young face, really, staring unceasingly at him. He figured he was in love. Finally she spoke. Colin, she said. Yes, Catherine. I'm breaking up with you. At the time, of course, Colin did not fully understand the significance of the moment. He immersed himself in Ovid, grieving his loss in silence, and she continued to watch him for the next half hour until her parents came into the living room to take her home. But it only took a few more Catherines for him to look back nostalgically upon the Great One as the perfect spokesperson for the Catherine phenomenon. Their 3-minute relationship was the thing itself in its most unadulterated form. It was the immutable tango between the dumper and the dumpee, the
coming and the seeing and the conquering and the returning home.